This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How big art thou? Oh, let me count the ways. Thou art too big to fail. Thou art too big to jail. Thou art... you get the picture. Banks on the broadcast today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 14th of March. Good, as always, to have you with us. And with apologies to Elizabeth Barrett Browning and Dr. Seuss, perhaps, as well, I'm obliged to point out that this is, for those of you who have an interest in these kinds of things, the fifth anniversary of the rescue of Bear Stearns by the Federal Reserve. The very moment, perhaps, when too big to fail became part of our contemporary economic lexicon. I mention that because this weekend, that is to say, 5 years on, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, Texas, a guy by the name of Richard Fisher, will speak at the big political meeting going on this week, the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC it's known as. And he is going to say in his speech that we ought to break up the big banks, that they are still TBTF. To get a little context, we've called John Carney from CNBC. He's one of our Friday regulars, as you know. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm very good, Kai.
So listen, it seems to me that besides too big to fail, which Mr. Fisher is going to talk about, there is too big to jail, there's too big to manage, there's too big to prosecute from the attorney general the other day. How many other ways can banks in this country be too big?
I mean, the main message is it's very true that they are all too big. The banks only got bigger following the financial crisis, and there's not a lot of economic gain even to the banks themselves of being that size. There's a lot of economic gain to running a bank that size because you can get tens of millions of dollars. But all the studies have shown that there's not a lot of economic efficiency beyond a certain level of growth.
Well, but here's the thing, John. I mean, you know, there is no small amount of hubris in the American banking system. Right. I mean, J.P. Morgan Chase and its CEO, Jamie Dimon, just being the most glaring example. How is it that that hasn't prompted more clear-headed thinking from regulators in this country?
I think the regulators and their bosses in, you know, on Capitol Hill, the congressmen and the senators, are mostly mentally captured by the big banks. They just think that this is the way things have to be. They've been taught to not even imagine a world without these banks. On the conservative side of the bench, you have people who say, well, that would be interference with the free market, even though there's nothing in the free market that makes the banks be this large. And on the liberal side, the banks say, you know, we wouldn't be, if you start cutting down our size, we won't be able to allow non-wealthy people to buy houses. That's not true, but it somehow has sunk in on Capitol Hill, and it's the dominant mindset there now.
You know, there's an interesting political dimension to this story, right? Because Richard Fisher, the president of the Dallas Fed, who has run for political office as a Democrat, although he maintains steadfastly he's nonpartisan in his current job, but he's a Democrat on the record. Is going to go into a very conservative political conference tomorrow. He's going to call for breaking up the banks. What's his reception going to be, do you think?
I think he's going to be very much welcomed. This is not – it's actually very interesting because we're so used to everything being so partisan divided in the you know, healthcare, sequester, all of these things we're fighting between Democrats and Republicans. But this really seems to be something that bridges the political spectrum where you have people on the left saying we should do something about this and then people on the right. CPAC is welcoming Fisher into their arms to make this speech to them. And that's what really makes it frustrating, that we don't seem to get anywhere with passing laws to make this stuff happen.
So here comes my favorite question. You ready?
I'm ready.
Did we waste the crisis of 5-6 years ago?
I think we did. I think what we should have done is tried to address the size of the banks, and instead our solution – and this may have been something we had to do at that moment, which was allow the strong banks to acquire the weak. But we should have been putting in place rules to make it tougher for the banks to be as large as they are, and we didn't do that.
All right. So here comes the big and depressing finish, John. Spitball it for me. In a year, on the 6th anniversary of Bear Stearns, if we call you up, are we going to basically be able to replay this whole conversation and it would be the same?
You don't even have to call me up. Just hit replay.
John Carney at CNBC. He's a regular on our Friday Wrap sometimes. John, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
On Wall Street today, well, let's see. More records? Yeah, had those. Bank stocks? Yeah, they were up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm going to pause now for a moment of silence to observe the passing of Google Reader. The company announced yesterday that come July, Reader will be no more. The 8-year-old service lets you pull information from a whole bunch of websites and blogs and get them all into one convenient place for your perusal. And I should say I'm not alone in my grief. Google Reader has, or had anyway, a lot of fans, just not enough of them to make it worth Google's while, as Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports.
Seriously? How am I going to do my job? Every morning I turn on my iPad and open Google Reader. And on one page, I can get stories from dozens of newspapers and blogs. And that's how I find stories, including this one. And if I want to add another newspaper to my reader, I just plug in the RSS feed. Joe Hall's an amateur coder. He says, think of Google Reader as a mailbox and RSS as the postal service or a way to deliver content. So Google takes your mailbox.
That doesn't stop the post office. The post office is still going to deliver mail.
He says, get another mailbox or another reader. There are plenty of them. Google says it's shutting down its reader because fewer people are using it. Whit Andrews is an analyst at Gartner.
That's not necessarily a surprise. It's not something where loads of kids today say, boy, I can't wait to get to my RSS feed.
Instead, they're turning to Twitter and Facebook for news. Google's known for experimenting with loads of products, from the self-driving car to the world's biggest digital library. And Andrew says since Google's co-founder Larry Page took over as CEO in 2011,
it's been pretty clear that he's trying to streamline the company.
So far, Page has killed about 70 Google projects. But one man's cast-off is another man's gold. Since the news broke of the Reader's imminent death, competitors like Feedly and Flipboard have been stepping up. And the tech thinking is that the Reader's end might be the beginning of something better. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
A week after the school shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, back in December, Wayne LaPierre, the CEO of the National Rifle Association, gave a speech. It was about guns and about safety and security and schools.
If we truly cherish our kids more than our money, more than our celebrities, more than our sports stadiums, we must give them the greatest level of protection possible. And that security is only available with properly trained, armed good guys.
A lot of schools already have good guys with guns. They're called school resource officers, but getting one in every school, that's actually a matter of resources, as Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Brad Pindell is the school resource officer in Westwood, Massachusetts. That's quintessential small-town New England, about half an hour south of Boston.
It's 10 square miles with a population of about 14,000 people.
Pindell grew up here. He's been a cop in Westwood for 12 years. SROs, that's what school resource officers call themselves, are not security guards. They're police officers. We get into a marked cruiser, and Pindell gives me a tour.
Sort of the downtown?
This is downtown. Downtown Westwood. All 200 yards.
Pindell's responsible for the high school, the middle school, and all 5 elementary schools. I ask him if he sees himself as the first line of defense, the guy who would stop a school shooter.
It's difficult to say because, I mean, being in charge of seven different schools, the chances of me being in that school when something happens are pretty slim.
There are about 10,000 SROs in the U.S. That's one for every 10 public schools. It would cost the Westwood police a lot of money to put an officer in every school. On average, Massachusetts police make about $60,000 a year. Westwood used to have two resource officers, but there were budget cuts. We drive by the Deerfield School, and Pindell mentions he's got three young kids.
Actually, one of them goes to that school we just passed. Certainly one of the things that ran through my head after Newtown.
Since 2000, the Justice Department has spent almost $1 billion to fund more than 7,000 SRO positions. President Obama wants to make more government money available so police departments can hire another 1,000 officers. Several groups, including the National PTA, say no one should have a gun at school, even a trained police officer. Other groups argue there's no evidence having armed security at schools makes a difference. So what does an officer like Brad Pindell actually do? He doesn't sit there and guard a school. Like many SROs, he doesn't have an office.
I try and stay in the high school the most and make myself visible because those are the kids that are going to have the most questions or have issues.
Pindell deals with bullies. He goes to court with kids in trouble. He teaches DARE. He meets with parents. Pindell also updates the school's crisis plan, what teachers and students are trained to do if there's a gunman. In his 6 years as an SRO, Pindell has never encountered a gun in a school. Pindell went through basic police training that lasts more than a month. Every year there's more training on everything from firearms to first aid. And he's been certified by the National Association of School Resource Officers.
Anybody have an idea what the three most important classroom lessons are that you can bring?
The association trains SROs across the country. Ernie Whiteman is teaching a week-long course in Leominster, Massachusetts, to about 24 officers. He says demand has increased since the Connecticut shooting.
Last I heard, we were scheduled for like 53 of them between now and the first part of August.
One officer at the training is Stephen Creamer. I ask him what he thinks of NRA CEO Wayne LaPierre's proposal to put a good guy with a gun in every school.
You know, it's good to have an armed person in a school, but they should be properly trained.
Over the last 3 decades, there have been about 150 shootings in U.S. schools. But the argument for armed security defies cost-benefit analysis. This week, the Board of Finance in Newtown, Connecticut, added $400,000 to the town's budget to put an armed police officer in every school. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up, a new way to pay for school, but it don't come cheap.
It's about connecting those two stages of life between an accomplished backer and a young prospect for the mutual benefit of both.
But first, let's do the numbers. Another new high and a near high on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials climbed 83 points, 0.5%, closed at 14,539, the 8th straight record close for the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 13 points, 0.4%, 3258 at the bell. The S&P 500 rose 8 points, that's 0.5%. Ended things at 1563. That is 2 points shy of an all-time high there. Energy stocks pumped up the market after a government report said natural gas supplies are tightening. WPX Energy, a natural gas producer, saw its shares rise nearly 5%. Cabot Oil and Gas picked up 3.8% today. Men's Warehouse soared 19% after the discount clothing chain reported a smaller-than-expected loss. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.03%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up March 15th. Are consumers experiencing inflation in their day-to-day living expenses? The Labor Department releases its monthly Consumer Price Index. In 1972, The Godfather premiered in New York City. Remember, never tell anyone outside the family what you were thinking again. And if you're superstitious, beware the Ides of March. For the rest of you, it's Friday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The city of Detroit has a very new and stark economic reality today. His name is Kevin Orr. Mr. Orr was installed today as Detroit's emergency financial manager by Governor Rick Snyder. It's a move that is not without controversy, but perhaps a little bit of hope as well. Micheline Maynard has covered Detroit for a whole lot of years. She writes now at Forbes.com. Hey, Mickey.
Hey, Kai.
So listen, what should we read into the fact that Kevin Orr is a bankruptcy lawyer? I mean, what he does is take people and companies and maybe towns into and out of bankruptcy.
Well, I don't know if he's taken any towns in and out of bankruptcy, but he put it best today. He called this the Olympics of restructuring.
Wow.
You know, Detroit always wanted to get the actual Olympics, and it's getting the Olympics of restructuring. This is going to set new precedent in terms of the way a city is run and the way a city is fixed.
Yeah, is it understating things to say he has broad powers?
Absolutely. So state law, actually the law that created the emergency financial manager was passed in 1990. This gives the financial manager basically the powers of a mayor plus more power. So if he wants to go after labor contracts, he's able to go after labor contracts. Mm. One thing I think a lot of people hope for is that the city streetlights will go back on because there are big swaths of Detroit that are in the dark, literally.
Wow. Time frame, is anybody talking about that?
He's got 18 months in his initial term. And, you know, the first day, opening day, is always optimistic. But honestly, I think he'll use that full period.
This is your neck of the woods. You've been in and covering Detroit for a long, long time. What's the vibe? How's it feel?
There's two schools of thought. Detroit's got this fledgling little recovery. There's been some new investment in the city. Everybody wants that to take flight. Then there's another side that thinks this is undemocratic, that the people of Detroit don't have a voice in this, and that this goes against the rights of the citizens to decide who's going to run their city and who's going to fix their city. I've covered this sad situation for a long, long time. As somebody who's seen the bankruptcies at the carmakers, I think they can fix Detroit, but they have to actually do the work.
Micheline Maynard, she is, as I said, a longtime Detroit journalist. You can read her on Forbes.com. Mickey, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
Parents among you know your job is never done, right? Well, it turns out a new study from Pew says a certain group of parents wants to work more, just not at the parenting part. Moms saying they want to work full-time has gone up significantly in the past 6 years, but society perhaps expects mom to be in a different place. Sally Herships has that story.
I was trying to figure out a modern take on that old saying, tied to your mother's apron strings, maybe glued to your mom's laptop, because more and more of today's moms want to work.
Families now really feel like they need two breadwinners.
Jennifer Sabatini-Freone is with Boston College's Center for Work and Family.
The recession has caused families to feel like both parents need to be in the workplace and more parents need to be working full time.
Almost 40% of today's moms who are already working say it would be ideal to work full time. That's almost double the number since Pew's 2007 survey. But it's not just the recession.
You know, when you think about it, part-time seems like it would be just the right answer.
Myra Strober is emeritus professor at Stanford. She says part-time work comes without benefits, but with expenses like childcare and transportation.
So instead of turning out to be the best of all possible worlds, for some women it turns out to be the worst.
Then there's society's opinion. The Pew Center says only 16% of parents agree that working full-time is best for kids, and that number hasn't changed in recent years. But working moms, you say you're better parents.
I think they feel like they need to be superwoman, and I think there is some level of confidence that comes from the ability to juggle it all.
So as mom might say, look on the bright side. Stay-at-home moms, you say you're happier than moms with jobs. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The immigration debate that we come back to every now and then focuses mostly on low-skilled workers, which makes sense. That's a pretty big group of people. But there is a whole nother set of people to consider, scientists and engineers, PhDs, ambitious people of one stripe or another who want to start companies here. There's no visa for that. So a couple of entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley have an idea. Why not set up shop just offshore? Actually, offshore. Think a floating office park in the Pacific Ocean. Max Marty is the CEO of Blue Seed, the startup in question. Max, it's good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So listen, Half Moon Bay is a lovely place and all, but what are you doing? Why are you doing this?
Well, Half Moon Bay happens to be connected to Silicon Valley, which is the most fantastic, one might say magical place in the world to create a startup, to create new technologies, new companies. And we are enabling people from all around the world to connect into Silicon Valley by positioning a cruise ship just 12 miles off the coast. And people live and work out there on their startup for about 6 months, 9 months. And then when they are in the right position and those companies have gotten a little bit of traction, be able to move them into Silicon Valley itself.
Help me understand how this might work. It would be a cruise ship out there. These entrepreneurs would live and pay you rent, I suppose. And then you run a shuttle craft in and out to the beach every day, right?
That's right. That's right. A ferry comes in and out every day. They pay rent. But more importantly, they provide us with equity in their companies, a small share, a small stake in that company. And that's where the real value is, not in charging rent. So the
real value for you.
Right. The real value for us and really the real value for the world is in the value that those companies are going to produce as they grow, as they produce new technologies, as they create jobs and all the rest.
One can't help but wonder, though, what the Department of Homeland Security thinks of you guys parking that ship out there 12.0001 miles off the shore and in effect saying, nah, 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 you can't get me.
Well, we've had a number of conversations with people in government and a couple of different legislators on the matter. Really, it's sort of filling in the rungs on the ladder that are unfortunately missing because of the lack of a startup visa right now. And at least so far, the people who we've spoken to in various levels of government have been very friendly about it.
We should say, for the record, there are investor visas, right? I mean, you can come here and plow a whole bunch of money into the economy and then get a visa that way. But you're talking specifically startup, entrepreneurial. I have this idea and I want to go to Silicon Valley, right?
Right, right.
What kind of interest have you had? Because I imagine you're going to want a bunch of deposits from these guys before you actually go out and buy your decommissioned cruise ship or whatever you're going to do.
Right. So we've so far had about $9 million reserved for a particular investor who's going to be coming in for our larger round. And we're bringing in an additional $18 million, and then we're ready to launch.
And when might that be?
If of all the financing goes well, then it would be Q2 of next year.
All right, we'll call you back. Max Marty, he's the CEO of Blue Seed. They're going to put a cruise ship off Half Moon Bay and run some entrepreneurs out of there. Max, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
If I said there's $1 trillion in student debt floating around out there, would I be over, under, or just about right? That last one would sadly be the answer. Americans of all ages still owe for their educations, but it's an especially heavy load for younger borrowers, which means, naturally, that capitalism has come up with a solution, a New York City startup that's offering an alternative funding model for people at the start of their careers, with one, we should say, quite sizable catch. From WNYC, Ilya Maritz reports.
I got a deal for you. First, think of a career that turns you on. Dream big. Let's say it's directing movies. Awesome. And since you have no experience, let's say you want to learn the craft at NYU Film School, tuition is $46,000. So here's that deal. Some wealthy investors are willing to place a bet on you. They'll give you the cash you need. All you have to do is pay them about 5% of your income every year for the next 10 years.
When you're young, you have, you know, a bit of initiative, you have energy, you have ideas, you have talent, but you don't have resources.
Salahoud is co-founder of the New York City startup called Pave.
So it's about connecting those two stages of life between an accomplished backer and a young prospect for the mutual benefit of both.
Notice how he says backer instead of lender and prospect instead of borrower. The investors who put their money into the Pave program have no guarantee they'll make a profit. They could even lose money. But if you become the next Jerry Bruckheimer, your backers could get rich. Remember, they collect a percentage of the young go-getter's earnings over the course of a decade.
My name is Terrence Ross. I'm a journalist.
Terrence Ross is a new prospect. He's 22, he graduates college this spring, and he wants to be a foreign correspondent. With a total of $20,000 from 8 backers, he plans to travel to Kenya.
To be able to do this now is exciting.
But I wondered, even if he finds a steady job in journalism, he could draw a pretty modest salary. And the contract Terrence Ross signed means he's legally bound to pay 4.5% of his income for the next 10 years. So what makes this different from indentured servitude? I put the question to co-founder Sal Lahoud.
I actually think it's the opposite, in the sense that you are giving young people, you're empowering them with the financial freedom to basically pursue their passions. I think loans, on the other hand, dictate choices.
Because you have to pay all the money back with interest on schedule. In recent years, there have been many attempts to reinvent the way we pay for big things through crowdfunding or peer-to-peer loans. Anya Kamenetz is author of the book Generation Debt. She remembers a lender that connected student borrowers with wealthy funders back in the early 2000s. It was called My Rich Uncle.
Very quickly, the model that they were trying to do, which was like what Pave's trying to do now, they found that they couldn't make it work financially. So they switched over to a more conventional private lending.
A few years later, My Rich Uncle folded. Kamenetz says Pave may face similar pressures. There is one thing she likes about the program, though. You can use the money to just get started on your career. You don't have to get a degree.
And I remember talking to friends of mine who got MFAs in playwriting, MFAs in novel writing. If only they could have gotten that money just to sit down and make the thing that they needed to make, they would have been much better off. They would have saved a lot of money.
So far, 8 young people are participating. They've each raised between $3,000 and $50,000, and Pave is looking for more prospects. In New York, I'm Ilya Meritz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, which speaks volumes about A, healthcare pricing in this country, and B, why the daily discount site Groupon is in such a very bad place. This offer popped up today in a friend of mine's inbox, an MRI, to include a carotid artery scan, brain aneurysm scan, or both, with 3D imaging and private consultation, starting at just $39. It's a $900 value, makes your savings 96-some-odd percent, or it's just crazy. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.